This is VOA News via remote, and I'm Laurel Bowman. The European Union readied its vaccine rollout Saturday, even as countries in the bloc were forced back into lockdown by a new strain of the virus, which has spread from Britain to France and Spain, and even as far as Japan. The pandemic has claimed more than 1.7 million lives and is still running rampant in much of the world, but the recent launching of vaccination campaigns has boosted hopes that 2021 could bring relief. First doses of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine arrived in Italy, Spain, and France on Saturday, ready for distribution to elderly care facilities and hospital staff. Vaccinations in all 27 European Union countries will begin on Sunday after regulators approve the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine on December 21st. Several countries, including Denmark, Lebanon, Germany, Australia, and the Netherlands, have reported cases of the new strain, which has sent jitters throughout overstretched healthcare services. The new strain of the virus, which experts fear is far more contagious, prompted more than 50 countries to impose travel restrictions on the UK, where it first emerged. Meantime, in Asia, China's communist leadership issued a statement hailing the extremely extraordinary glory of its handling of the virus that emerged in the country's Hubei province last year, state news agency Xinhua reported, and in the post-Soviet nation of Turkmenistan, where the government claims no coronavirus cases. The president, who is a former dentist, claimed that licorice root could stop coronavirus from developing. He presented no evidence to prove that. For more on these and other stories making international news headlines, we invite you to visit our website at voanews.com. This is VOA News. India's government detained at least 75 Kashmiri political leaders and activists to forestall political unrest after an alliance of Kashmir's regional political parties won a local election. This is according to leaders and a police official speaking on Saturday. The district council election, concluded early this week, was the first such exercise since Prime Minister Narendra Modi's government last year revoked the special status of the Muslim-majority Indian-controlled region. New Delhi then cracked down on the opposition and rounded up hundreds of people to preempt protests and violence. U.S. whistleblower Edward Snowden's wife has given birth to a son. Photographs posted on her social media page on Saturday showed, "Happy holidays from our newly expanded family," Lindsay Mills wrote, sharing photographs on Instagram of the couple holding the newborn. Britain on Saturday published the text of its narrow trade agreement with the European Union just 5 days before it exits one of the world's biggest trading blocs in its most significant global shift since the loss of empire. The text includes a 1,200-plus page trade document, as well as agreements on nuclear energy, exchanging classified information, civil nuclear energy, and a series of joint declarations. George Blake, who died in Russia on Saturday at the age of 98, was the last in a line of British spies whose secret work for the Soviet Union humiliated the intelligence establishment when it was discovered at the height of the Cold War. Britain says he exposed the identities of hundreds of Western agents across Eastern Europe in the 1950s, some of whom were executed as a result of his treason. U.S. President Donald Trump is spending the holiday weekend at his Florida resort as both Democrats and Republicans wait to see whether he will sign a critical pandemic relief and government funding package that he sharply criticized earlier this week. The legislation, which includes $892 billion for coronavirus relief, was flown from Washington to the president's Mar-a-Lago Club in Palm Beach for him to sign into law. But the president surprised lawmakers in both parties by labeling the legislation a disgrace. Trump said the package gave too much money to special interests and foreign aid and said direct payments of $600 for most Americans should be increased to $2,000. A partial federal government shutdown looms early Tuesday if Trump does not sign the bill. Congress is planning to return to work Monday and could take up a stopgap measure to extend government funding. Via remote, Laurel Bowman, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in the Ghanaian capital, Accra.
If you look at this year's election, MPP filed a lot of young women. NDC did the same. And it gives me hope. It gives me confidence that, yes, there's future for us, but we need to start working. We don't need to relax. We need to work and keep pushing them to do the right thing.
A Ghanaian activist calls for more female empowerment to take up political positions.
The Ugandan authorities have to stop the evictions forthwith, and also ensure that the necessary steps or measures are put in place to ensure that the people in Apar are able to vote.
Human Rights Watch warns that residents in Apar village may be unable to vote in next year's general election in Uganda.
We cannot allow closed nationalisms to prevent us from living like the true human family that we are, the Pope said, adding that we cannot allow the virus of radical individualism to win and make us indifferent to the suffering of others.
And Pope Francis calls on the world's nations to share COVID-19 vaccines. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. A prominent Ghanaian gender activist says the country's two leading political parties should enable women to participate at the grassroots and top echelons of their parties. Esther Teria is the founder and executive director, Gender Center for Empowering Development. She says both the governing New Patriotic Party, NPP, and the main opposition party, National Democratic Congress, or NDC, will need to empower their female members to compete for positions in parliament and other political institutions in the West African country. Her remarks follow reports of a lack of significant progress for women candidates in the recent general election. Although there were marginal gains in female representation in the legislative body, activists say the parties need to do more. For an in-depth look into the performance of female parliamentary candidates in Ghana's recent general election, I caught up with Ms. Esther Teria of the Gender Center for Empowering Development.
Generally, I would say we've been able to add 0.05 to it. Now we have 14%. It's a little push, but we could have done better. But I don't fault the women in this space. My concern and my problem has always been with the political parties. Because right from the primaries level, where the candidate selection process go through, they didn't give opportunity for a lot of women. And so if you see the women who won in the both parties, NPP and then the New Patriotic Party and the National Democratic Congress, is 2020. And these people, during their candidate selection stage, they gave 24 women. NDC gave 24 women the nod. NPP also gave 25 women. And where we lost out on the nine was that some of the women were contesting among themselves.
Were you happy, or are you happy about the performance of these women during the elections?
Of course, I'm happy because they've been able to pull their way through to win. But of course, I would say that it would have been better if the political class, the political institution, I'm concerned about them because they are the major democratic institution that we overlook when we are talking about women's political representation and participation. The focus has always been, let's mentor the women, let's build their capacity, let's do this. But the question has to be, what are these people doing to make their environment more enabling for the women?
Now, there was an agreement among these political parties to have more female representatives or candidates. Whatever happened to that agreement between these political parties? In order to have more female candidates, we need to create avenues for them in order for them to thrive and represent the party in various aspects of the political dynamics of the country. What happened?
So you see, for me, I think that issues about gender, women's representation to the two parties has been an afterthought, and also like a something to just to score or tick the box that, oh, we've mentioned them. They will tell you, oh, we have reduced filing fee for the women. That isn't enough. There are a lot of things that they do internally that inhibit women's participation. I tell you this, the women's organizer, do you know it's not an independent role in the party? The women organizer is under the national organizer. So you see how the party structure is. It's like we are doing you a favor, so you are under the national organizer. And then what happens is that they have a national budget, and which is being controlled by the national organizer. And the national organizer will say, okay, take this and do this. And even if you go to the party offices, the women organizers don't have full secretariats that works for them. Could say that we are able to force our people to do, make sure certain things that affect women in the parties are being addressed. We did a research during this election looking at the violence against women within the political parties. That is a major barrier to women's political participation. About 58% of women said, oh yes, we've gone through sexual harassment, we've gone through this, physical assault, and verbal, you know, those kind of things, stereotyping and all that.
What do you think are the prospects of women participation in Ghanaian politics, let's say in the next cycle of elections?
Huge. Why do I say huge? Now you see lots of young girls, lots of young women coming up boldly to say that I belong to this party, I belong to that party. This is the time for us, groups like us, to start engaging them and grooming them, at least building few capacities here and there for them to position themselves well in the parties, be, like I said, card-bearing members and all that, active members, so that they can reap the benefits. So for me, I see a lot of prospects both in MPP and NDC. There's a lot coming up. If you look at this year's election, MPP filed a lot of young women. NDC did the same, and it gives me hope. It gives me confidence that, yes, there's future for us, but we need to start working. We don't need to relax. We need to work and work and keep pushing them to do the right thing.
Esther Teria is the founder and executive director, Gender Center for Empowering Development. She spoke with me from the Ghanaian capital, Accra. Rights Watch is expressing concern that residents of a northern Ugandan village will be disenfranchised from voting in next year's general election. The rights group says thousands of people in Apar in northern Uganda may not be able to vote in the January 14 elections if they are not included in the recently compiled voters register. In a new report, Human Rights Watch says following disputes with the authorities, the Electoral Commission did not register residents of the village. Opposition groups say this is yet another indication that the government continues to violate the rights of citizens to carry out their civic duty to vote and choose their own leaders. For more on the calls for the Electoral Commission and the government to act quickly to ensure residents of Apar village are registered to vote, I reach Otieno Namwaya, a senior researcher at Human Rights Watch.
We have been carrying out research in northern Uganda for a couple of months now. And we released the findings of the research today. In the research, we are saying that we found that when Ugandan government, the Electoral Commission was conducting voter registration and updating of the voter register from sometime late last year to early this year, it ignored or did not carry out a similar exercise in an area called Apar in northern Uganda. And that means that those people who qualified to be voters since 2016 have not been registered and therefore will not participate in the coming elections. The Ugandan government has been trying for a long time, for the past 10 years, to evict the residents of Apar. in order to pave way for that area to become a forest reserve, but it has not succeeded. So the refusal to register them as voters is, in our view, part of the pressure to force the people of Apar to move out of the area and leave the area for government acquisition. The problem is that government is not following the law, and also it is not consulting with the
Otieno, does that mean that with this action, their rights are being violated, because it's their constitutional duty to choose their next leader as Ugandans?
Yes, that is correct. Their rights are being violated in many different ways. One is with regard to the elections. It means they will not participate, and therefore their right to be able to participate alongside other parts of the country or other Ugandans to choose the next leader shall have been denied. The second one is that because we are looking at this as a way of government forcing the residents to vacate the area, we are looking at this as a deliberate a government effort to not follow the law while evicting these the residents, and therefore violating their rights to dignity. The government is trying to force the residents out of their areas of residence without, one, compensating them, and two, without providing an alternative settlement, which the government of Uganda ought to do before even thinking of evicting anyone.
What recourse do they have in order to address this challenge of the forceful eviction and non-compensation, an action taken by the government that you have identified?
I think the recourse, the immediate recourse here is the law. And because the government is violating the law, the first step should be for the Ugandan government to stop the evictions. The second is that if the evictions are to take place at all, then the government has to follow the international protocol, which is, one, to at least consult with the residents of that area and provide adequate compensation. I think some time back, the Ugandan government provided some compensation, which was far from adequate. It was more like a mockery of the situation.
So, Otieno, what is the key recommendations to resolve this concern?
The key recommendation is, like I mentioned, that the Ugandan authorities have to stop the evictions forthwith, and also ensure that the necessary steps or measures are put in place to ensure that the people in Apar are able to vote.
Otieno Namwaya is a senior researcher at Human Rights Watch. He spoke with me from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. In Cameroon, thousands of Muslims are joining Christians in churches all over the country in Christmas prayers for peace in 2021. For the annual tradition this year, the Interdenominational Prayer for Peace group focused on Cameroon's troubled western regions and COVID-19. For VOA, Moki Edward Kenzeka reports from the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé.
Rabbana taqabbal minna innaka antas samiul alim wa tub alayna.
Muslims in Cameroon joined together with Christians Friday to celebrate Christmas and offer an annual prayer for peace. Sheikh Umaru Malam is president of the Islamic Superior Council of Cameroon and a member of the Interdenominational Prayer for Peace group. This year, he says, they prayed for an end to COVID-19 and peace on the border with Nigeria, where security forces have been battling the Islamist militant group Boko Haram for close to 10 years. Malam says they prayed especially for an end to the separatist conflict in Cameroon's western regions, which has left more than 3,000 people dead and displaced hundreds of thousands.
Be loyal to your country. Compete for goodness through social work and community service to enhance people's life and improve the progress of society. Let us be united, building our nation. Let us be united for peace, safety, security, unity, reconciliation, and prosperity.
Anglophone rebels have been fighting in the western regions since 2016 to carve out an independent state from Cameroon's French-speaking majority. The separatists have destroyed symbols of the state, such as schools and bridges, as well as mosques and churches. Reverend Father Humphrey Tatambui is Director of Communication at the National Episcopal Conference of Cameroon's Catholic Bishops. He spoke by telephone from the northwestern town of Bamenda, the capital of the troubled region.
If there is any Cameroonian who has not learned from the four-year war that might, force, violence, does not, will not, cannot, and should not be able to solve a problem, then I wonder if that person will ever learn. What is going on is horrendous. And therefore, justice and peace should be the message that all of us should talk about. We have everything to gain in peace than in war.
Long time ago in Bethlehem,
Christmas songs play on the speakers at the Our Lady of Victories Metropolitan Cathedral in Cameroon's capital, Yaoundé. Far from the separatist conflict, the focus is on another battle to defeat COVID-19. Cameroon instructed churches to guard against the spread of COVID-19 during Christmas Day activities. To fight the spread of the virus, Cameroon's churches are holding multiple Christmas Day services. Church usher Christian Olinga says they are also limiting access to the cathedral. He says the Catholic Church asked him to make sure the government's instructions are respected. No one will be granted access to the cathedral without a face mask. Olinga says worshippers and guests must sit 2 meters from each other, and there are enough hand-washing basins and sanitizers in the church. Cameroon has confirmed nearly 26,000 cases of COVID-19 and more than 400 deaths since the first case in March. A surge of more than 2,000 new infections this month raised concern that holiday gatherings could see numbers increase further. Meanwhile, Cameroon's Muslims and Christians are praying for a healthy and peaceful new year. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Pope Francis has called on the world's nations to share COVID-19 vaccines, saying that walls of nationalism must not be built in the face of a pandemic that knows no borders. He urged international cooperation so everyone can receive needed health care and vaccines. For VOA, Sabina Castelfranco reports from Rome.
In his Christmas message to the world, delivered indoors rather than as customary on the balcony of St. Peter's Basilica, Pope Francis said that in these times of darkness and uncertainty due to the pandemic, there are some lights of hope, like the discovery of vaccines against COVID-19. But in order for these lights to shine and bring hope to the entire world, the Pope added, they must be made available to all. Pope Francis urged the world's nations to ensure that vaccines are provided for everyone, especially for the most vulnerable in all the regions on our planet. We cannot allow closed nationalisms to prevent us from living like the true human family that we are, the Pope said, adding that we cannot allow the virus of radical individualism to win and make us indifferent to the suffering of others. The Pope focused much of his message Friday on the coronavirus pandemic before turning to the world's hotspots and nations of concern. He urged the world to work together, irrespective of differences.
In questo momento storico,
The Pope said, at this moment in history, marked by the ecological crisis and grave economic and social imbalances, only worsened by the coronavirus pandemic, it is all the more important for us to acknowledge one another as brothers and sisters. Pope Francis spoke of the need to be generous, supportive, and helpful, especially towards those who are vulnerable, the sick, those unemployed, or experiencing hardship due to the economic effects of the pandemic, and women who have suffered domestic violence during these months of lockdown. In the face of a challenge that knows no borders, the Pope said, we cannot erect walls. All of us are in the same boat. In his message, Pope Francis also turned his thoughts to the many children who, all over the world, particularly in Syria, Iraq, and Yemen, still pay the high price of war. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
Kenya and Somalia have agreed to try to reduce diplomatic tensions at a conference this week in Djibouti. Mogadishu cut ties with Nairobi last week over alleged interference with its sovereignty. Despite the attempt to de-escalate, the Somali government and a Somali region friendly to Kenya are building up troops in a border area, sparking fear of military conflict. For VOA, Mohamed Yusuf reports from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
There's growing concern the tensions between Kenya and Somalia may erupt into fighting due to a military build-up along the two countries' borders. The Somali federal government has sent troops to the border town of Beled Hawo, while forces from Somalia's Jubaland region, which enjoys a good relationship with Kenya, are stationed in the nearby Kenyan town of Mandera. Mohamed Maalim Mahmoud is a Mandera County senator. He says his people should not bear the brunt of the bad diplomatic relations between the two countries.
We don't want a situation where these two forces fight and our people's lives are endangered. We have now Kenya and Somalia, apparently their relations is not good for the last few days, but this should not be borne by the Kenya Mandera people.
Hundreds of fighters allied to Jubaland Interior Minister Abdirashid Janan have been stationed in Mandera for months. Last March, these forces launched a cross-border attack in Beled Hawo, killing dozens. On Tuesday, Mandera residents took to the streets to demand the Jubaland forces to leave and stop endangering their lives. The protest took place after the Somali government sent hundreds of soldiers to secure the Beled Hawo area. 50-year-old Jama Warsame is one of elders in Beled Hawo. He says the residents of the town cannot afford to flee their homes this time of the year. Warsame says that during this time it is really hot, dry, and there is a drought. He says, we are so much against any conflict this time. He says, we would like to urge our government that is in control of the area to find a solution and reach an agreement with those who are opposing it so that they can enjoy the peace we have now. Last week, Somalia cut diplomatic ties with Kenya. The federal government accuses Kenya of interfering with its internal affairs, an accusation that Kenyan officials deny. George Musamali is the head of the Center for Risk Management in Africa. He says any conflict between Kenya and Somalia will be felt beyond the border area.
We've always been having incursions from across the border inside Kenya. The place has always been volatile. And now that you are seeing the buildup of forces along the border, then definitely this is going to make this a major threat for security in the entire area. And it's going to affect not only Kenya, it's going to affect the Great Lakes region in general. And I believe we need to have a diplomatic solution to this role, as opposed to bringing forces along the border, clearly indicating that there's hostility.
For its part, the Jubaland government has insisted on the withdrawal of government forces in the neighbouring Gedo region, a demand that the government in Mogadishu has refused to accept. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
And you are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in the Ghanaian capital, Accra. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from my collection of music from the continent. But first, the UN Refugee Agency says improved security has allowed 3,000 refugees from Mali return to a camp in Burkina Faso they abandoned 9 months ago following attacks by armed extremists. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
Some 9,000 Malians in Burkina Faso's Gudubo refugee camp fled in terror when they came under fire by armed extremists in March. About 5,000 made the difficult decision to return to Mali, a country still in turmoil. The UN Refugee Agency assisted them upon arrival. Many of the remaining refugees fled to the nearby town of Dori, where they've been living under dire conditions. UNHCR spokeswoman Shabia Mantu tells VOA that national authorities have reinforced security in and around Gudubo, making it possible for the refugees to return to the camp.
For the 3,000 that have returned back to the camp, they were relocated in 31 convoys of buses and trucks to the camp. So another 150 refugees arrived on their own in motorcycles or in tricycle taxis, and others moved on foot accompanying their cattle.
Mantu says another 2,100 refugees are expected to move back to Gudubo from Mentau camp this month. She says the Malians will have better access to services in the camp. She says 1,500 new shelters have been built, health clinics have been refurbished, schools are welcoming students, and returning refugees have begun reopening small businesses.
But despite the welcome relocations, we're continuing to warn that attacks by armed groups in the Sahel will lead to further displacement in a region that's already hosting 2 million IDPs and hundreds of thousands of refugees. Across the Sahel, refugees, internally displaced people and their hosts are subjected to brutal violence, rape, executions. It's really horrible. And now the COVID pandemic is adding a new layer of hardships.
Burkina Faso is at the epicenter of one of the world's fastest growing displacement and protection crises. The UNHCR says more than 1 million people in the country are internally displaced, and more than 20,000 Malians have taken refuge there. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Sudanese living in the United States say the year 2020 has been a difficult one for them as they struggled with COVID-19-related issues and the political development in Sudan. The Sudanese Americans hope that 2021 will see restoration of peace across Sudan. For VOA, Nabil Biagio has more from Washington.
35-year-old Abdul Halim Hassan is a Sudanese American living in Pennsylvania. He says it has been difficult living with COVID-19 measures while juggling school and work, but he says following developments back home in Sudan with the slow transition to democracy has given him reason to be optimistic. He says he wants to see a peaceful and just Sudan in 2021.
We hope in the new year, 2021, that we can have a comprehensive peace agreement, and those are wanted by the ICC should go to the court, and we see justice in Sudan, and also we hope that we can have a full civilian-led government, because that's what it should be. And that's what the demands of the Sudanese people. Sudanese people want peace and justice and democracy in Sudan, and that cannot be happened with the military in power.
Hassan says he received the news of Sudan's removal from the U.S. list of state sponsors of terrorism with jubilation earlier this month. He says normalizing U.S.-Sudanese relations will allow members of the diaspora like him to support their relatives and friends back home.
I hope the U.S. can maintain and collaborate closely to ensure that all the benefits goes to the people directly. And also we as a diaspora, We have been struggling to support or to send money to our families back home. This will help us also to support our families back home and to be in contact with them daily basis through the technology, and also we can help to improve the education system and to exchange the capacities and skills between the U.S. And Sudan.
58-year-old Adlan Abdulaziz, who lives in Virginia, recently returned from a visit to Sudan, where he says he saw positive signs that the country is making a transition to democracy. He says what gives him hope, above all else, is the fact that Sudan's transitional government signed a peace agreement with rebel groups in October.
No civil wars. The peace agreement that was signed in Juba. And we hope to see this in the ground, and people getting back from the camps, the displaced people coming back to their villages and normal life from camps, and to have some kind of security.
Abdulaziz says he would like to see Sudan transform to a full-fledged civilian government where all the country's resources and government businesses are managed by civilians, not the military.
I'm hoping that in 2021, that the Ministry of Finance of the Treasury, Department of Treasury, to have a full control on all state-owned companies. According to Hamdok, 82% of the state-owned companies are managed by the military, and they need to go back and hand it over to the Treasury. This is the thing that I hope will be done in 2021. And also that the people in the displaced camp go back to their villages and go back to their normal life securely and in a peace and security.
46-year-old Ibrahim Tahir Ahmed, who lives in the East Coast state of Virginia, just outside Washington, D.C., says he watched events starting with the ousting of President Omar al-Bashir in 2019 and the developments that followed back home with pride, and hopes the U.S. will stand with Sudan in its difficult transition in the new year.
We as Sudanese and as American, we are very proud of the great revolution and the great U.S. work, U.S. government effort in order to help the Sudanese people. But still, we hope from the government to use all possible means in order to show, like, those forces that preventing and trying to stop the transformation of the power in Sudan.
Ahmed says he hopes the United States will help Sudan get rid of all remnants of the Bashir administration, including people who, he says, are working hard to undermine Sudan's transition to democracy. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Washington.
And right now it's time for music from our African collection.
mutia yeze chikiri komanda omupyate mutia. Body and I'm gonna show you fire. Kana kaza nyona kafuna mwe balua. We can be.
Kama najikosea naanza kurudi na kuendelea watu mapenzi ndo nakolea kikuona tu ndo nazidi chochea ayo maneno alokuambia sio uongo kweli kweli huku kilema nimetupa magogo nimefeli sielewi asara bila umaro mwambie bwana wako anafunga anavojitapa mtani
Yes,
That was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, Managing Editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, and producer Saida Hamdun, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, on a dead tree, there are no monkeys. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in the Ghanaian capital, Accra. Good evening, Africa.